There was a night, walking towards the hall. My mind ran back to a very old memory. It was the very first prepared speech that I had to give at school. It's just a young boy, just like right now. The topic was cleanliness is next to godliness. It was a really good topic, but I absolutely hated it. What I hated, or what I strongly disliked, was the fact that I had to prepare for it. Only God knows how much time I had to put in to practice that one speech. I think I had, what, about 10 minutes? 10 to 15 minutes? But the number of times I had to go over that script. We had a very close family friend who was an English teacher. And she was ever so kind to help me prepare for that speech. So she wrote the speech up for me. And then I said, what do we do now? She said, practice. What else? So a few times I read it out in front of her, and then she corrected my pronunciation. And she said, no, that's not how you say it. This is how you say it, and so on. I was very young, just like right now. But I really did not enjoy practicing for that speech. And I remember, once I got into school that day, it was a speech contest. So every year we had these competitions at school, and that was a speech contest that I was preparing for. So I went in and I gave my speech. To this day I can remember how nervous I was, my knees trembling, my mouth dried up in an instant, my palms were all sweaty. It was dry where I wanted it to be wet, and it was wet where I wanted to be dry. And I could feel my heart just pounding as if it wanted to somehow escape from my body and jump out. That's how I felt that day. It was so vivid, that experience, and that's how I can still remember it. It was self-torture. I was thinking to myself, because I didn't expect it to be that bad. Because I practiced in front of the mirror. I practiced with my parents and the family friend. I didn't have many friends back then. Well, I did, only the friends I had at school. It was when I used to live in Oman. Spent a good few years there. So school was about an hour and a half from home. And so I didn't have many friends where I lived. So it's just my brother, me, and my parents. And not many people my age around that area. So any practice I only did with my family and in front of the mirror. But it was a very different experience when I was actually there on the stage, my teachers in front of me, the students in front of me, and I had to do it somehow. So the reason that, anyway, it came to my mind just like that, and then it made me giggle. I was giggling to myself as I was walking down out of the lift and into this room. Only because I was telling myself and thinking to myself how I don't have to prepare for these speeches anymore. And I was telling myself, you know, if I had to prepare for each of these talks, that was a 10 to 15 minute talk. These talks sometimes don't seem like they're ever going to end. Right? You are on the receiving end of that, you know that. And then one every week. I had plenty of time to practice for that. But if I had to practice a speech, and come and practice and give this speech here, week on week, this would simply be impossible. I would not do it. Not for all the love I have for you, I would not do that. So very fortunately, I don't have to come prepared for these speeches. In fact, I have no idea what I'm going to be talking to you about today. That's why I'm just blabbering around, you know, just beating around the bush, just don't know where to start. Some or other we'll find a strand somewhere and then we'll just start climbing up. Like those beanstalks. But it is all thanks to the Dhamma. And I have no words to express how relaxed I am right now to come and talk to this audience. You know, speaking to an audience used to be not a very fun thing to do. I was not an introvert even back then. I mean, I was comfortable talking to people, but I did it because it had to be done. I was okay, but that did not mean I was not nervous. It was always there. I was just very good at hiding my nervousness. I think that's how I'd put it. I could feel my heart racing, but I was able to hide it and pretend like I was very, very casual, you know. Like I was very comfortable. I was able to give a good show. But now, it's not so. You know, you can bring a stethoscope and place it here and you see. No different to when I was leaving the monastery this morning. There's no nervousness. No anxiety, no performance anxieties or anything like that. Because I'm not here to impress. You're already impressed. This is the impression that I have made upon you. Something must have happened for me to come this far in my life. This could not have happened just for nothing, random. Right? So that is the impression I've already made on you. And that's the impression that you see over here. So I'm not here to make an impression per se. I'm here to sell the Dhamma to you, the sasana, yes. But it is not for my own benefit, it's for your benefit. Therefore, whether you take it or not, that's to you. If you take it, that's for you. If you don't, again, that's for you. But that just makes it easier for me to do what I have to do here. There is zero expectation. It is not that you must take this, I must make a good impression, I must impress you so that I can get an award at the end of this, or a medal or a cup. There's none of that. Frankly, I don't care what you think about me. As long as I get some alms at the end of this sermon. But I do care what you think about yourselves. I don't care about what you think about me, it's about what you think about yourselves. So I'm here to introduce you to yourselves. Is that not so? I'm here to help you understand who you are, not who I am. And to make sense of who you are and why you do the things you do and why you can't make sense of some of the things that you go through. But the Dhamma is that's the greatest gift I've ever received in my life. It's just like a source of infinite wisdom. All I have to do is just let the Dhamma flow through me. And this is not my, I'm not the only one who has this gift. Anyone who has been gifted the gift of Dhamma, all they have to do is just have compassion towards the people they are willing to speak to and open their mouths and start speaking. So I don't think any monk who's worth his salt needs to really come prepared to give a talk. These are not prepared speeches. Oftentimes I thank you, don't I? Even last week, there was one of those moments where I said, thank you, Rajakirins. Because we went through, we were talking about something and all of a sudden it came across a particular point, and I said, I'd never actually looked at this in this, from this perspective. So the environment is always very, this is perfectly conducive to drawing on that wisdom of Dhamma. But most of all, I feel super relaxed. I feel so at ease. And this is who I am. I don't have to pretend to be someone. I don't have to come prepared for these speeches. I'm never nervous or worried about whether we might have something to say, whether I'll have nothing, nothing to say. It's never happened. Something or the other. It's always been something useful, hopefully. And the proof is in the pudding, isn't it? Already we have a few of you back at home. So we have seen results. And there are many of you who are now very much devoted to the sasana. You have gone from being simply devotees to devoted, which is just a jump, it's a leap. So all of that is thanks to the Dhamma. I don't have to come prepared for these speeches. That is such a relief. Trust me. Such a relief that I don't have to come prepared for these speeches. And if I ever did come prepared for these speeches, it would seem very unnatural. You would not be able to relate to them. Not on a personal level. You know, I can come prepared with a speech on desire, aversion, delusion, something like that. I'll come here and give you the perfect speech. You know, syllable for syllable, it'll be perfect. I will have found the perfect analogies, the perfect metaphors, the best similes that I could come up with, right? And I come prepared and give that speech. You will understand it. But I doubt many of you will come up to me and say, Swami Nansa, you spoke to me. You spoke and it hit right at home, right where it matters. I don't think I would hear those stories from you. Because it would make sense, but I doubt it will make an impact. I think that's because we just let the Dhamma flow. This is the collective merit. This is the environment. Let's throw the seeds and see what happens. So let's see what happens today, shall we? Then to get us started, it's not I today who has that distinct honor. It is a young man who is now a young monk. I always say almost venerable, Dinidu Puta, Dinidu Kapukottuva, he was his lay name, spent very many years of his life in Australia. It was there he came across the teaching. See, sometimes to get the Dhamma you have to go abroad. So, go. Sometimes, you know, what's next door, you only hear after you've travelled many thousands of miles, and then you somehow found this YouTube channel. Oh, there are plenty of stories like that. You know, within a few kilometres of the monastery, and they only found the Dhamma online. Many people have come up to me and said stories like that. So this young man, very smart, he's got a good head on his shoulders, and his good head is only second to his good heart. As a young Anagarika, I loved him to pieces. He's a really good chap. You would have had the opportunity to associate with him while he was here, helping set up the sermon hall. Very respectful. Doesn't say much, but he's got a lot going on in his head. And he's also the pioneer to the sasana in his family. In his extended family, he's got a distant cousin, a brother, who is already a monk with us, that in his extended family. But in his immediate family, his nuclear family, he is the first. And when I say he's the first, I mean it. What do I mean? That he's not the last. And walking in his footsteps as his father, his brother, and his mother. They were down for his ordination ceremony, and they're already going through the interview processes to come in and join the Jetanarama family. See? The whole family turned upside down. You know, just imagine, folks, you know, what dreams and ambitions they must have had when they uprooted themselves from this country and took themselves across the shore, across the seas. A dream, the Australian dream. Like I once had, the UK dream. Going in search of greener pastures, where the grass is always greener on the other side. It's always the case, isn't it? Ever hopeful. But then to somehow have enough merits to be so far away from home, where his home was supposed to be, where he was supposed to find his home, to be so far away from home, and yet to discover that the truth was only a skip and a hop away. And then to come back, all of them. That must tell you something. Those stories must tell you something. He will relate his story to you, or some parts of it at least with you, to give you a bit of an insight as to what happened in his life and how this Dhamma transformed his life. But I know little about, I know something about what happened with him and his family. And these are those transformational stories, you know, from a life that was looking forward to extravagance. Today is a life looking forward to enlightenment. Just imagine how he must have grown up in a land where, you know, there's everything. All you have to do is just a bit of hard work and you can get it. You know, it's a land of opportunities. To now be in the land of the Buddha, the land of the opportunity, not opportunities, but the opportunity. The young boy who went looking for joy came back home when he found that true freedom was only a hop away. So without further ado then, it is my greatest honor to invite the then almost but now most venerable, the Venerable Kumburegama Dhamma Ruchi Thero, up onto the dais. And I invite him most respectfully to precept the audience, his family of Dharmishta Rajagirians, a community that is not foreign to him at all, a community where he experienced friendship, joy, happiness, family. So he's come back to tell you how he used this platform, this community, how you were there to help him climb up the ladder and achieve this milestone in his life. And I hope he will join me once he has finished to give your heartiest blessings and not forget that you were all once parents to this young boy. Perhaps not in this life, but we have been through sansara for so long, ladies and gentlemen, that there isn't a soul here who's not mothered him, fathered him. So now, he's embarked on this journey to repay those debts and that will be his calling to you. Venerable sir, those are the words of a son who has just very gratefully spoken to many, many, many parents. And he spoke from the heart. I could feel the genuineness in every word. In fact, he is very humbling to see how he's looked at this whole setup and this community and the perspectives that through which he has seen it and the reasons for which he is grateful today. I often tell you that there are many people behind this camera. You only see one man, but there are many. And he is one of them, or at least he was one of them. I often tell you how these sermons would not be possible if not for all of you, each and every one of you, doing your merits week on week, coming here, creating this really amiable environment, this communal feeling that you have, and this sense of brotherhood that you extend to one another, which makes people want to keep coming back. And the best thing is, you keep wanting people coming back, people who have merits. That's the best thing about this. People who have merits. Those are people who we should spend time with. Because when you have come across someone who has merits, that's like a rich man. He's a truly rich man. Because if we spend time with a rich man, chances are we can learn how to become rich ourselves. The universal currency is merits, isn't it? Not dollars or pounds. The universal currency is merits. And that is why he repeated several times over, merits, merits, merits. The merits that he earned by coming here, by serving you, by setting up these cameras, by bringing Swami Nuances here, by answering your Dhamma questions. I didn't know he did that. But that's wonderful. The fact that you feel confident to even take your questions to our Anagarika Mahathyas. I love that. People who are a little bit more relatable to you. If you see me in a robe, you see them in clothes and attire, somewhat close to what you come here in. At least that's a little bit more relatable. So then to get their perspective on how the life of an Anagarika is, how they see the Dhamma. I could be giving you tall tales for all you care, right? But to get it from them, to hear it from in their words. And it was music to my ears to hear him say that there was days where he would take your questions back to the monastery, contemplate, perhaps went and spent time in the Velimalu. Maybe that is the question he took to his teacher during his Guru Hamu, his teacher's meeting. He would have probably put his question to his teacher and said, there's a devotee at Rajagiri who's come and asked me this question. I want to be able to answer their question for them so that they can experience the same joy that you and I do. Venerable sir, please can you help me figure this out? So the following day he would have come back. Now I remember there were occasions when on the way back from Rajagiri he would ask me questions in the car, not letting me take my baby nap. How about this? How about that? How do you look at something like this? Swami Nuhas, he would ask me. So now I know. I hadn't figured it out. So is it any surprise today that he has earned the merits and the privilege and the honor The universe has rewarded him. That's how I would put it. The universe has rewarded him. You've got to earn this, ladies and gentlemen. Things that come for free, you have to earn them. You can't buy them. To earn something and to buy something are two different things, aren't they? You can buy a house, but you have to earn respect. You can't buy that. You can buy a car, but you have to earn a mother's love. To earn a mother's love, you have to have enough merits to be born human, to a human mother. You can't buy that. You can't buy a sermon. These are not for sale. It could be that you're the richest man in the world, but if you didn't have the merits to listen to a sermon, I'd go mute in front of them. To have enough merit to be rich is a different kind of merit to be in the presence of the Dhamma, Noble Association. And in that regard, you are all very blessed. That is why the Buddha established the Mahasangha. If the Buddha and Dhamma alone were enough, he would not have bothered with the Mahasangha. In fact, much of the hard work he had to do in his last life was to set up the Sangha, to go on foot, walking miles at a stretch, stopping village to village, door to door, talking to people, sharing with them the profound truths that he had realized, and then creating the sasana, laying down the rules and code of conduct when it was time to do so, answering their questions, solving their problems. You can imagine what it must have been, to set up a new community, something that did not exist, to start up an organization. If you have any experience of setting up an organization, right? He set up an organization that was to last 5,000 years. Hundreds of thousands of people joined, even during the Buddha's era. And to this day, we are still members of that grand organization. But unlike other organizations, this one is a little bit different, because we here are organized to disorganize. That is the difference between this organization and every other organization in this world. All other organizations come into being to thrive, to remain, to last, to exist till the end of time. Whereas this organization, the very purpose of this organization is to organize humans, to organize minds, to organize beings, people, whose ultimate goal is to perish, to go into non-existence. Swaminarayan's last words were, and call of him, it was a call to you, it was an invitation to experience the same bliss and serenity that he experiences. To stop running on that treadmill. Because you're all running a treadmill. Like the donkey behind the carrot last week. You're getting used to this mockery now, aren't you? Good. But don't get used to it. Don't get too used to it. Because then you'll just be okay with it. These are all little talkers. What do you call a talker? A knock? Okay. A little knock on the head, just to remind, a gentle invitation. To say, it's time. It's time, come forth. Come forward. But to get off this treadmill, you need some wisdom. Intelligence alone will not help you do that. Intelligence will help you come up with and make sense of a logical argument. But for your internals to agree with your intelligence, you need wisdom, ladies and gentlemen. Now, ever before, even before we spoke to you, you were exhausted with life. That happened way before Swaminathan has talked to you, you heard the Dhamma, you were already exhausted with life. But you had no alternative. Life was difficult, but it had to go on. You knew that there would not be, and there is not much point in going after the many things that you'd been used to going after in life, but what was the alternative? What were the choices? Either you should give everything up and be deemed a loser in society, and then people laugh at you, you become the laughing stock anyway. They think of you as unsuccessful people, and then you are discredited, dishonored. This is not something you are comfortable with either. Why is that? Why do you not like people dishonoring you? Because of? Ah, yes, good, you know it. Because of your sense of self, in other words, ego. So ego always gets in the way and says, ah, what did he just say about me? And then you want to have a word with them. You want to say something back. So because of that, you can't just do nothing either. You can't just remain uneducated. Now, let's be honest, if you take a large number of this audience itself, I think you educated yourself far more than you really needed to for survival. Would you not agree with me on that matter? So you went to school, right? Let's say that's the bare minimum for everyone, right? But if you pass grade 8, you can get a job, some job. Right? But let's say we went on just a little bit more, right? Do your O-levels, did your A-levels. You don't really have to go to university to get a job for survival, right? But once you start pushing those boundaries, A-levels, degrees, right? These are those certain, you know, thresholds you have to cross, those boundaries you have to cross to get yourself a decent job, not just any old job. It's not for survival. This is to have a good life. And to have an even better life, you can't stop at that either, because there's too much competition at that level. Then you must go even further, masters. If you talk simply about education, I mean. And then you have to do various other qualifications, professional qualifications, right? You've got to get them under your belt. And then you have to keep pushing to, you know, maybe get up to PhD levels and that sort of thing. All for what? To live the good life, not just any old life. But you don't need, do you really think you need all that for survival? To be free of hunger, do you need all that? Do you need a degree to be free of hunger? What degree does he have? He's only 19. You don't need a degree to be free of hunger. You don't need a degree to have shelter. But if you want a big house, if you want a good house, a nice house, then you have to get a degree. Because a degree opens up what? Doors. They open doors to greater opportunities, right? To greater sources of wealth. Therefore, the more you want to acquire, the more you have to keep pushing yourself forward. Whose story am I relating right now? Just mine, right? Not yours. Now let's say, you know, in our country, if you want to get somewhere, you have to be able to speak a bit of English. Yes? Ah. Sometimes it doesn't even matter what you know, as long as you can speak a bit of English. Right? That opens a lot of opportunities. I didn't make the rules, so don't look at me like that. I'm just saying this is how it is. In much of the third world, especially those countries where there was, you know, the British colonized some time ago, this is true. If you can rub shoulders with people who speak good English, then you know there are a lot of opportunities that open up. Sometimes even without the qualifications. You don't always have to have the qualifications. Therefore, from a very young age, what do our parents try and get us to do? Learn English. So if you had the choice, would you send your child to a local school or an international school? Okay, local schools then? That's what you said, right? Sinhala medium or English medium? There's a natural answer that comes to your mind. Because you know, to rub shoulders with the right people, you have to be able to communicate, speak good English. So you have to keep pushing forward in that avenue as well. So it's not just enough to have the qualifications, you also have to be able to have the linguistic skills. This is all to live the good life. But you don't need that for survival. To have 3 square meals, to have a shelter over your head, to have treatment when you're ill, right? You don't need all that to be clothed. You don't need all that. But when you want to fulfill these dreams that are put into our heads, then we have to keep pushing ourselves forward. You know, there's nothing particularly wrong with that except for this. Number one, you're living someone else's dream. You see, I for one, and I think you will agree with me, I went to university myself, yes, I did my degrees and all that, but not because I wanted to, it's because I had to. That was not the path I would have paid for myself if I had the choice. It's kind of like going to a restaurant. You can't just order whatever you like. You have to go by the menu. So they bring the menu and they say, pick one. Is that not so? You go to a restaurant and the waiter brings the menu, right? And what do you want? You pick something. So when it comes to education, isn't that the same thing that happened with us? Did you not have to learn some subjects at school which you really had no interest in? And then when you know, went past certain grades and then you didn't have to learn them anymore, were you like, good riddance? You didn't have to learn them anymore? Even when you did your degrees, perhaps, you know, there would have still been some modules, some things that you really didn't like learning, but you had to because that was how it was all curated. Not your choosing. So it's someone else's road that you have to walk. You have to make do with that. So someone else came before you and they said, this is the life that you have to live. Whose life? Whose life? Your life. Live to whose rules? Someone else's rules. And that's how your pet dog is at home, isn't it? I'm just saying. Whose life? The dog's life. Right? But where does he live? The place where? You decide. What does he eat? Whatever you decide. When does he sleep? Whenever you decide. When does he go for a walk? Whenever you decide. What if he doesn't want to go on a walk at that time? Oh, that doesn't matter. You want to go on a walk, so you take him for a walk. Why? Because he's your dog. He's your what? Dog. He's your dog. So what does a dog have to do? Live its life by the master's rules, yes. Whatever the master wants to do with it, it just has to surrender. Does your dog get to live in whichever part of the house he wants? No, you decide that. In some places where the dog is not allowed to, if it ever walks in there, what do you do? Yeah, you chase him out or teach him a lesson, he never forgets. Typically they forget and they come back, but you try and teach them a lesson. So by becoming your dog, that dog lost its sense of independence. Don't you agree? Before it was your dog, if it ever had the freedom to be not your dog, if it ever had the freedom to be its own master, he would have eaten whenever it wanted to, slept whenever it wanted to, went for a walk whenever it wanted to, found any old mate that it wanted to. But now he can't find whatever mate he wants to. You do the mating for him as well. That also you get to decide, right? He doesn't get to pick his girlfriend now, right? You do that for him. But that was not so. If he wanted to go and sleep under a tree, he would do that. But now, no. Now, there's a standard that he has to... I keep saying he sounds better than it. I mean, after all, it's your dog, right? It's not just any old dog, so he's okay. So now, this dog of yours, he has to surrender to his master. At what cost? Independence. The one thing that we fought for many years. Yeah? Our ancestors, they fought for it, right? Independence. And what did you do after that? You brought a dog home. And you stripped that animal of all its independence. You know, you will tell me, but we give the dog a good life. We groom the dog, we take the dog to the vet, we inoculate the animal, right? All of which he would not get, Swami Nohansa, if we just let it go stray. See, my dog gets dog food. I buy the premium product. Not just any old dog food. We don't just feed it leftovers. We buy it from the supermarket. And my dog gets fed before my husband does. In some households, maybe that is true as well. Who knows? It just depends, you know, that's the priority order in terms of how much you love someone, right? That decides the order in which someone gets fed. So first the children, dog, husband, and that's how it works. But at what cost to the dog? It's independence. You know, see, now when the Suddhas were here, the British, when they were here, and then we all fought for our independence. Right? And then they finally gave us our country and they left. See, they would say the same, wouldn't they? When they were here, they built the trains, the tracks, right? They developed our country. And they could say all sorts of things about how well they did whatever they thought was right for our country. Yet, you fought for independence. You, meaning your grandparents and their grandparents and so on. So, although that is true for us, it's not so true about our dogs then, is it? For our dogs, we think it's right that they are domesticated and we decide what's right for them. But when the British were here, it's not okay for them to decide what's right for us. We have to decide what's right for us. How hypocritical. But the point I'm trying to make is this. When we have to surrender our independence, we become a dog to someone, some other master. You're running a treadmill, ladies and gentlemen. I was talking about education. We don't choose what education we want. I mean, they'll give us some options, yes. They'll give us some choices. You can go to the best school in the country and they'll say, we have all these different choices, but you can't do whatever you want. You can't do a course in making kompittu, can you? You can't do that. You have to pick from a list. So who's decided that is right? That what is right for you? Someone else has. The system has. The rulers have. The people who govern, they have. Competition has. Consumerism has. Globalization has. The people who decide how to get you to spend your money. They have decided what courses you have to take, what subjects you have to learn. Therefore, we are on that treadmill. Take your TV. Right? Some of you will have satellite TV. You get it for free or do you pay for it? You pay for it. Right? Take a subscription, these video services. A very popular one is Netflix. Right? So you get that. Who pays for it? You pay for it. Can you watch absolutely anything you want? Or do you have to pick from a list? You've got to pick. So no matter which one you pick, you're still watching something that someone else wants you to watch. Show me how you can be free from that. Show me how you could be free from that, if at all possible. You go to the restaurant, you can't decide what you want to eat. You have to pick from a list, meaning someone else has decided what it is you want to eat. Or you can say, but Swami, so you can go to a different restaurant. Yeah, you can go to a different restaurant, but at that restaurant you have the same rules. Someone else decides what's on the menu. So you can pick Chinese, Mongolian, Indian, Japanese. You know, you can pick that, you can pick your cuisine, but you can't pick what's on the menu, or rather what goes into the menu. You can only select from the menu. When you go to the supermarket, let's say you don't go to restaurants, you cook your own food. Okay? Where do you buy your produce, your fresh produce? Again, from the shop, from the supermarket, from the vendor. So when you go there, what's there? Again, what someone else has decided, you're going to eat this for the next couple of days. So what's at the fair, what's at the vegetable stall, what's at the supermarket, that's all been pre-curated. You just have to select something so that someone else has decided is what's right for you. Do you see that in life, the same applies to every facet of life? Be that education, be that your food, be that your medicine, anything for that matter. If you want to go on a, you know, take a break, you want to go on a holiday. Again, you might go online, do a quick search, and they will tell you these are the holidays that you can pick from, and you have to pick one of them. So whenever you make these choices, you're making choices that have already been made, really. So these are already shoes that you just have to put your foot into. The shoes have already been made. You just have to put your feet into them and start walking. That's it. You can't make your own shoes. So you're not truly free. Independence is only a dream. To be truly independent, ladies and gentlemen, you have to be free from the want for all of those things. If you can be free of the desire for those things, if you can be free of the wanting for those things, that is when you can say you're independent. Until then, you're not really independent. You are always dependent on there being all these choices and then for you to pick one. That's the best we can do. So this treadmill business, a good example, this treadmill business is you just keep running, making or selecting choices that have already been made by others, therefore you are never fulfilled because those choices were made by someone else. Those options were made available by someone else. It's not what's right for you. It's what they thought was right for you. We always say the possibilities are endless, the world's your oyster and all these phrases, but ultimately, what's possible is only what has been made available to you. Among those things, you can make one or two selections, but that's it. And the more access you have, the more wealth you have, the more opportunities are available to you. So this is why you have to keep pushing those boundaries. Keep going forward. Educate yourself more than what is necessary for survival. I have to admit, I am one who educated myself for more than just survival. Because survival was not what I had in mind. To thrive was what I had in mind. To be the best. But if the best is still trying to better themselves, then who is the best? Surely once you get to the top, you should be able to stop. Like Swami Nase said, if you are the richest man in the world, then you are the richest man in the world, but then why do they try to become richer? What's the point of being the richest man in the world if the richest man in the world is doing what the second richest man in the world is also doing? What is the second richest man in the world doing? Trying to become richer. What's the richest man in the world doing? Trying to become richer. Then what's the point then? You tell me. Listen, you tell me, what's the point then? What's the point of climbing up that ladder? A ladder that has no end. You cannot get to the top. Well, what's the point then? This is why it's a treadmill of a life. That's why you're exhausted. You just keep running and running and running and running, and one day you just fall off the treadmill. Which is this event that we call death. But you're born again and you start running the treadmill again. This endless existence, meaningless, must be a problem to you. It must have become a problem to you, and if it hasn't, it must soon become a problem to you, because it is only when that becomes a problem do you start to look for a solution. Until then, the sasana is of no value to you, frankly. Because you don't get anything else from the sasana. You don't get anything else from these sermons. These sermons are to help those individuals who have come to this realization that you're on a treadmill, you're running, there's no end, but no matter how much you run, you don't achieve anything tangible, nothing substantial, but you're exhausted nonetheless. What do I do? How do I come out of this? The day that this becomes your problem, the sasana is here to help you. That is where the Buddha starts his dispensation. Until then, you have no need for the Buddha. Until then, you need educated people in life. You have to associate with them. You got to go and speak to your bank manager until then, not the Buddha. Not the local monk. You got to go and speak to the local bank manager. You got to go and speak to your teacher. You got to go and speak to the professor. You got to go and speak to the engineer, to the doctor, to whoever. But the day you realize that all these pursuits are really meaningless, because they don't get you anywhere. There's no ultimate destination. Have you found an ultimate destination? Think of your careers, for instance. Your careers, right? Whatever career you're in. Can you define for me the ultimate destination of your career? Any of you? Can you define the ultimate destination? Is there any point at which you can say, that's it, once you reach there, you don't have to do anything. You can just stop. Let's say you become the most educated, the most skilled, the most talented engineer in your profession. Once you get there, can you stop? What if you become the best teacher in our country? Well, there are many other countries. Okay, what if you become the best teacher in the world? Can you stop? No, because you have to continuously be on the pursuit of new knowledge. If there isn't enough knowledge, you have to create new knowledge. That's what PhDs do. That's what a doctorate is all about. You've got to create new knowledge. Isn't that what you get? For those of you who've done your PhDs or who are already on track, isn't that what a PhD is about? You've got to create new knowledge. That's what research does. Create new knowledge. And once that is done, to remain relevant, what must you do? Keep on going. In business, is there a point you can bring your business up to and then say, that's it, done. That's it. My business is done. From here, I just have to relax and rest and enjoy the rewards of my business. the returns on my business. Can you do that? Can you? No, you can't. Of course not. Because a business is always susceptible to its environment. So when competition arises, new people come, enter the market, right? Customers' desires and wants change. You have new clients, new economies. Right? All that changes all the time. All of the time. Therefore, you must always remain relevant. Therefore, that also is a treadmill. Education is a treadmill. Business is a treadmill. Earning money is a treadmill. So everything outside your front door is a treadmill. Right, then let's go indoors. If only things outside is a treadmill, let's go indoors. Okay, you're a good husband. You have a happy married life. Done? So once you achieve a happy married life, you think that's it, done? Or must you constantly keep working at it? You tell me, the last 20 birthdays you never forgot. What if you forget the 21st one? Ever since you married, the last 20 birthdays you never forgot. There was always, you know, you gave a card, there was flowers, there was friends, there was a party, there was a little whatever, something special. The 21st birthday that you have had, you know, you've been with your wife for 21 years now, the 21st birthday, but you forget. But you said it's done. You have a happy, successful married life. Is there such a thing? So which wedding anniversary can you choose to forget and it'll be okay? Which one? Name it. 10th, 11th, 12th, 15th, 20th, 100th. If your marriage will last that long. Because none of these things are permanent. None of these things are fixed. All of these things require endless, constant, incessant maintenance. In other words, they're all treadmills. To remain on a treadmill, what must you do? Keep running. To remain on a treadmill, you must keep running. To remain in business, what must you do? Keep running. To remain in a job, what must you do? Say you're employed, right? In some organizations, one of the finest organizations in the country. To remain employed, what must you do? Keep running. To remain a student of this school, what do you think that child must do? Keep running. A member of staff? Teachers? What do you think this school must do to remain a good school? And its management? Keep running. And parents to afford to send their children to this school? What do you think they must do? Keep running. Yeah. Marriage? To keep marriage, to make marriage last, what must you keep doing? Keep running. Away from each other, right? No, it's a treadmill. Marriage is a treadmill. Friendships? What about friendships? Must you not give them a call once in a while? Find out how they're doing? Even when you have no particular need to contact them still, you have to contact them, right? Check in, see how they're doing. At least go on their wall and, like something, photos or something. Just put a comment in to say that, you're still interested in them. Because you can't just go and say, hey, I need some money. Right? I need a favor. You can't just go in and randomly ask for favors like that, out of the blue. You have to keep that relationship. You got to keep the fire burning. So you have to keep putting wood in there. Right? You got to keep throwing wood into the fire so that one day when you need the warmth of the fire, you can go and sit by it. Don't you agree? So then what about friendships? What are they? They're also treadmills. And the thing with treadmills is, they are inclined. Meaning you can't just stop. You got to keep running and you got to keep accelerating. So you can't run at a steady speed. You have to keep accelerating. Otherwise, you can't remain relevant. You won't last. Survival is a treadmill. Because to remain the fittest, when there's always competition from around all corners, you've got to keep running. That's why you're exhausted. But you're not getting anywhere, but you're running anyway. Name one venture you're invested in that you think is not a treadmill. In a worldly context, I mean. So don't throw Nibbana into this now. You have something? Why do you retire? Because you're exhausted. We look forward to our retirement. Some people don't like retirement actually, because it makes them feel irrelevant after all those years of feeling relevant, after all those years of recognition and acknowledgement, and you know, you getting the pedestal, people walking up to you, talking to you, asking you for your help and support with things. All of a sudden, you're no longer the boss. You're no longer the person everyone comes up to. You're no longer the bee's knees. People don't care about you anymore. So, you know, they pay you to remain at home. They say, please don't come to work. We'll pay you. Can you stay at home? Do us a favor. You know, from one aspect, that is what retirement is, right? They pay you to not come into work. All these years they've been paying you to come into work. Now they start paying you to not come into work because you're that much of a... that. Because now you're more hassle than worth. Then comes retirement. Even your retirement pay, right, they don't pay, give you that for nothing. This is money that you have been putting into your retirement pot. So they're just giving you back your own money. Yes, the organization would have put in a bit of their contribution as well. That's just to incentivize you, because what you don't... do you know what they do with your retirement money? With your retirement funds? Huh? They make money. So it's really a bit of a gimmick. So they take part of your salary, which, you know, there's never an assurance that you will get it back, because you don't have to live long enough to get at least some of your pension back, right? But you're getting to that age where to remain alive feels like a miracle, let alone healthy. So at that point is when you start receiving your... what is the pension age this now? Statutory pension age? 50? 60? Ladies at 50. For gents? 60. Okay. But they keep raising that age from time to time, don't they? Yeah, they keep raising that age because... yeah, so without overly complicating this, I noticed soon after I threw the question to the audience, there are experts in pensions and people who are already on it. So they are very strongly opinionated about how pensions should work, but they don't. I regretted that soon after I threw the question to the audience, right? So I take that back, no questions. You retire at whatever age you retire, but you can't retire young, right? So the statutory age is 50-something, right? 50-something, 60-something. But I know for a fact that they keep raising this age, right, from time to time. That is because they want to try and get more out of you, and they want to give little back to you, because the less you live, the less that they'll have to repay, but the longer they can get from you. And with that money, what they do with that money is they invest it and they make more out of it. So really, it's not doing you a favor, they're doing themselves a favor. That's how it works. I'm not here to discourage you from saving into pensions. I'm just saying that's the way the world works. I mean, it's only because they do that they can pay you a pension. But that's how it works. That's how savings work. The other day I think I spoke to you about this. I was a banker for many years, so I studied how savings work, and I realized that that was the biggest joke of all. To take your money, right, and to give you very little back in return, what the bank does is, it pulls a lot of cash and then it lends it out at high interest rates and puts it into investments, because you have little on your own, you don't have much to invest. And when you talk about large investment projects, you need a lot of cash for that. A lot of capital, which we don't have individually. So what do banks do? They go and do these huge investments, make a lot out of it. That's why the bankers live good lives. Haven't you seen them? That's how they used to pay our big bonuses at the end of the years. But to the clients, to the just the average individual who puts their money into the bank, what do they get? Hardly anything. It's nothing worth writing home about. You wonder why you bother going to the bank to open the savings account, right? Sometimes to put your money in it. But you can't put it under your pillow or under the mattress, right? So you have to put it somewhere you think is safe, and there you put it in the bank. You know, the truth is, ladies and gentlemen, you never get anything by saving. You can only get something by spending. The banks know this. So they take your money and they spend it. They only save what they're required to save. There are regulations that stipulate that they have to keep some reserves in the event that things go wrong. And they're always negotiating with the regulatory bodies as to why they have to have so much in reserve. Because banks understand that to make money, they have to spend money. Just like merits. The universe does not favor those who save. The universe favors those who spend. See, if you keep hoarding something, very soon you'll stop getting it. But if you keep giving something, forever you will keep getting it. Give and you shall get. Keep. And then what you have to do is, if you start keeping something for yourself, now you'll have to start protecting it. Yeah, that's the punishment. If you give something, how much effort must you put into protect it? If you always give what you have, how much effort must you put in to protect it? You don't, right? See? Isn't that a bonus of giving? But if you save something for yourself, what must you do? Protect it. That's the punishment for saving something. That's why the banks give you back little, because they have to save. That is the price you have to pay for saving. But the bank itself does not save, it spends. Anyway, that's a short lesson, 101 on banking. But the truth is, I mean, these fundamental truths, you see them wherever you go. You see them wherever you go. Be that in any part of life, even for merits, the same thing applies. That's why I always encourage you to give, to share, not to hoard and to keep for yourself. Because then you become the protector. And that's a job on its own. It's a job of itself to protect. For as long as your son or your daughter is with you, check your daughter. Your daughter is with you, who has to protect your daughter? You have to. The day you give her to someone, then they have to, see? So what must young men do? Relieve burdened parents of the duty of protecting their daughters, right? That's why young men are very generous. So they sacrifice their freedom and they go and relieve, right, parents of the heavy duty and responsibility of protecting their daughters. They're like those banks. Forgive me for saying what I'm about to say next. What do banks do with your money? I'll leave it there. But it's food for thought. That was a little kick up your backside. So for 20, 25 long years, you protect, you save. Huh? And then on her 25th, give her to the bank. The bank doesn't save. The bank uses what you have worked so hard to save. The bank uses it. That's how the bankers have fun. You're intelligent enough to work out, read between the lines. It's what you did, gents, when you brought your wife home. And it's what you did, ladies, when you brought your husband home. Relieve those parents of the duties and responsibilities of looking after their children, but only so that you can do what the bankers do. Let's leave that there. I'm here to just open your eyes, to look at the same thing that you've been looking for many years of your life, but from a different angle. That's what I'm here to do. This may be disruptive. It's not intentionally disruptive. It's intended to be eye-opening. I'm inviting you to look at what you've always been looking at, but from a fresh angle, fresh perspective, because you have been indoctrinated. That's a problem. Many before you have been doing something, and like I said earlier, we are just running on a treadmill. Like going to the restaurant and picking something off the menu. When you came into this world, there were various ways in which people had already determined how they were supposed to live their lives. So your path was already paved. 13 years of school you had to do. University, 2, 3, 4, 5 years of university you had to do. Then dating you had to do. After that, getting married was what you're supposed to do. And soon after that, having children, starting a family, settling down, building a house, getting yourself a job, and then working your way up in that job, climbing up the career ladder, saving up for retirement. That's what you're supposed to do. But that's not what you were born to do. This is where I see that huge contradiction. Here's a Swaminarayana who has discovered that that is what, not what he was born to do. That is why he is in a robe and you're in lay clothes. That's how you live the lay life and he lives the noble life. Because he discovered at a very young age, much earlier than I did, much sooner than I did, he discovered what he was born for and what he was born to do. You are 45 now. 46, 47, 50, 55, 60, 65, going 70, 80, 90. And you still haven't figured out what you were born to do. Therefore, what are you doing? Just running that treadmill. Just running on that treadmill because that was what you were placed on. From the moment you were born, you were placed on a treadmill. And soon after you get to the top of that treadmill, another treadmill awaited. And then you go and jump on that one. And then that one after that, another one, and another one, and another one, and another one. Those are the ones I just talked about. 13 years on one treadmill. And then another 5 years on another treadmill. Then the job treadmill. The spouse treadmill. The children treadmill. The house treadmill. The work treadmill. The career treadmill. All these treadmills. All of these treadmills are on this big treadmill called the life treadmill. Birth to death, that's what we do, just keep running on these treadmills, never really getting anywhere besides death. That's the only destination you ever get to, nowhere else. But you are never content either. Should we not be a little bit smarter than that? To just ask ourselves, why is it that I'm putting so much effort into my life, into my the life of my family, my children, right? And still, I'm not content. Are you content? If you are, then why are you here? Half of you will not show up next week because I asked that question. But that's okay. I'm not here for the crowd. I'm here for you. The very fact that you are here for a sermon, right, tells you what? That something's not right with your life. What did you come here looking for? Answers. That's what you have come here looking for, answers. Did you not find them in marriage? How come you're here? Did you not find them in marriage? Did you not find them at school? University? Did you not find them in your wealth that you have amassed over the last many years of your career? What about the nice house that you have built together? Did you not find the answers that you were looking for in your house, in your property? Perhaps in your children? How many of them do you have now? 2, 3, 4, 5? You not found the answers you were looking for in them? The answer is, yes, you haven't. That's why you're here, still looking for answers. That's why those who have a lot are on the audience side, and he who has nothing is on the speaker's side. Something doesn't seem right, does it? Logically speaking, I should be the one in the audience. You should all be giving me lectures. Mustn't you? Swami Nazi, listen to me. This is how to become successful, Swami Nazi. And let me point out where you went wrong, Swami Nazi. But you picked the wrong course, Swami Nazi. You should have done law. You did IT, Swami. That's where the problem is. IT is where the problem is. That's not what you should have done. You should have done economics. You should have done science, Swami Nazi. That's what you should have done. See, I'm successful, is what you should have told me. Well, this is what you should be telling me. How come you're the one listening to this talk and I'm the one giving the talk? How come he who has nothing is giving a talk to an audience full of people who has lots and have achieved lots and have gone places? What does that tell you about what we are doing here? You're on a treadmill. You're still bamboozled. You don't know what's going on. That's the problem. You have a lot, but you don't know what to do with them. You know how to earn a lot, but you don't know what after that, what's next. You know how to keep climbing this career ladder, but you keep going up and keep going up and keep going up, and there still seems to be many more rungs to climb. You ask the question, Raminas, where does this end? That's what you're asking me. That's why you're here. Because you have this dream that at the end will be the final rung, and once you put your foot on that, you'll be like, done. But you've tried that now for many years. See, just look at this audience, ladies and gentlemen. I don't know whether you can see what I can see. Right? There are many faces. There's the young, and there's the not so young. Shall I put it that way? There are people who live modest lives. There are people who live lives of luxury. There are people who claim to have little, and there are people who claim to have a lot. There are the underachieved and there are the overachieved. There are the undergraduates and there are the overgraduates. There are school students and there are PhD holders. There are singletons and there are couples. There are wannabe parents and there are parents to 2, 3, 4 children. everyone's here. And you're telling me, I am the one who missed the boat. I am the one who missed the trick. Are you telling me that these mills that you're running on, these treadmills you're running on, are getting you where you want to be? Is that why you're all here? Otherwise, you know, if marriage is the solution, if that's the golden key, then those who are married should not be here. Give me a hand, give me a show of hands, those who are married. Ah, good. Right. Unmarried. See? We have both. I mean, let's have a scientific, right, proper conversation here. Because we have to go by evidence, right? So if both the married and the unmarried are here, then neither of them are satisfied. I know, I'm just throwing facts at you. You tell me you agree or disagree. I don't mind. I'm happy either way. I'm just trying to make a point to you, and if you don't agree with me, it's fine. You can deny. You can refuse these facts. No, Swami, that's not right. But what I'm saying is, just stating the facts, there are the married and the unmarried. So there are some among you may be thinking, well, you know, marriage, yes, I got it wrong, so I should divorce. Then I'll be fine. I'm not going to ask, can the divorce put their hand up? But I can tell you that there are several here, because you have come up to me and shared with me your personal stories and how your pursuit of happiness somehow ended in a divorce, and you thought that's where you were going to find your happiness. And some of you stopped there, but others then went for a second shy. So didn't learn their lesson the first time round. And you are still here. So if divorce is the answer, right, then the divorcees should not be here. If you think you were too quick to go for a divorce, then the second time married, they should not be here. Yes or no? There you go. If you are educated to above undergraduate level, put your hand up, please. Degree and above. First degree and above. Okay, thank you. Hands down. So the rest of you haven't done their first degrees yet. Well, they're both here. So if you're thinking your degree, that is the thing that's going to give you satisfaction, fulfillment and enjoyment in life, well, I'm sorry to pop that bubble. Because the degree holders are here as well. They're also here looking for solutions. Looking for answers. Then there'll be those who live on rent. There'll be those who have their own house. Householders, please put your hand up. If you have a house to your name. You're not renting like me. Okay, put your hands down. So there are those who are homeowners and those who are renting. And they're both here. So what is this dream that you have, once I get my house, once I buy my house or build my house, once I become a house owner, that's the day when my life is going to be complete. I mean, just come and sit here, come. I will ask the questions, you look at the audience. What does that tell you, ladies and gentlemen? You know, this is a social experiment. I didn't pick the audience, you just came at random. And this audience is large enough for me to ask these questions and for us to draw some conclusions. Grandparents, put your hand up, please. Grandparents. Uh-huh. See, there are grandparents. Put your hands down. Thank you. So those who think that it's when you become a grandparent you're going to be happy with your life. Finally. Huh? When you have a few little grandchildren running around, you can play with them. And just cuddle with them and just, you know, your life is going to feel complete. You know, there are several grandparents here and the point is they're still here. Now what does that tell you about life? That becoming a grandparent is not the answer. Parents, put your hand up. Okay, put your hands down. Those who are not parents yet, please put your hand up. Yet, of course. Yes. Okay, put your hands down. Right, so those of you who think that it's because you haven't become a parent yet, that's why you're not happy in life, right? And you're already starting to make plans about how we can become parents, and then our lives will just be complete when that beautiful little thing pops out. Completing our lives, right? And we'll feel like, you know, a little gift of God has been placed in our hands. Then why are the parents here? What did God do? Not what? Dump in their hands. They gave them a gift as well. But they're still, they're here. What does that tell you? But parenthood is not the dream to go for. See, I mean, these are those very general goals and dreams and ambitions that people have in their minds. Right, let's do another one. And thank you for being such good sports, right? You're all very, very selflessly contributing to this conversation. Thank you, I admire that. And I admire your honesty, I admire your candidness, and I admire your contribution to this very meaningful conversation, because you are helping someone else understand the reality of life. You're earning merits as you speak the truth and share your life experience with me. Put your hand up if you ever traveled the world. Okay, hands down. Those who have never. Anyone who's never traveled? Ah, there are a few. Okay, so for anyone who thinks that the day you start traveling the world is the day that you're going to be happy, many of them have. The vast majority of the audience put their hand up and said, those who've traveled, put your hand up. The vast majority put their hand up. Just a few put their hand up to the subsequent question. So what does that tell you about those who've traveled? Have they found their happiness? Have they found the answers? Those of you who've got homes in another part of the world, put your hand up. If you've got a home in another part of the world, ah, thank you. Put your hands down. See? They're also here. They, like I, once thought that if I make home in some other part of the world where everything is just fantastic, where there's all the opportunities and life's dreams can be realized, and they took themselves from here, traveled across the oceans, settled themselves down, built their homes or bought their homes, and they're back here. What does that tell you? If that was where the answers were, why did they come back? Think. So see, we have the educated, we have the wealthy, we have the families, we have the parents, we have the grandparents, we have the traveled and the non-traveled, we have those who have residencies around the world, and we have those who don't. We have the lot. How much further do you want me to keep going? Isn't this enough evidence for you to at least come to this idea, this conclusion that we've still missed what it is that life was supposed to give us, what we were supposed to find in life, figure out? But the funniest thing of all is this, ladies and gentlemen. Those things that I just talked about a few moments ago, aren't they the dreams and ambitions that you have in your life? From a very young age, were they not the dreams and ambitions that we set for ourselves, the goals that we set for ourselves? I remember, because I was a very goal-oriented person. When I came across this goal-oriented mindset and, you know, having a strategy for life, setting goals and, you know, planning life and all that personal development stuff, soon after I discovered all that, I started setting out very structured plans and goals for life. And I was very steadfast on that. So I was on the pursuit of all of those things. A good education, a good family life, have property, acquire wealth. But those were the things that I thought would give me satisfaction. There's only one thing that happened to me for me to give up on all of those things just like that, overnight. Just one thing. I discovered what I'd been looking for. Not in those pursuits. They were not there. That's why you don't find them there, because it's not there. You can't find a tortoise with wings, no matter where you look, because they don't exist. You can walk up to a lake at night when there's a full moon in the sky. Look into the lake and you'll see there's a bright object. You think to yourself that that's the moon. Then you try getting to the water to try and find the moon, because it seems like it's in the water. How much swimming around is going to help you find that moon? Once you get into the water. But come back out and look at it. Where does it look like it is? It's in the water. Get into the water again. A second attempt. Spend longer. First try, you only spend a few minutes. This time, spend a few hours. See if you can find the moon. Will you? No. What if you see other people in the water? That's what happens typically. When you walk up to the lake, you'll see a lot of people swimming around. You're like, hey, what are you doing? We are looking for the moon. You say, what moon? See, look. Have a look. Can't you see it? Yeah, it's there. So you see it as well. Of course you see it. But it's only the reflection. But because there are others swimming around in the lake, hoping that they will find the moon in the lake, what do? You also get into it. You also jump into it. That's what's happened to all of you. Pretty much every one of you is swimming around in this lake of life, trying to find the moon, because there were others before you who did the same. And when you walked up to that lake, there were plenty others there swimming around, crazy people trying to find the moon in the water. And you know, you can't fault them, because if you walk back out, get out of the water and come back and stand on the bank and look at the lake, what do you see again? The moon. You can't fault them. It's a very pathetic situation. You can't fault them. So how many people are swimming in this lake looking for the moon? Countless. Everyone up your street, they're all in there. Everyone at your workplace, they're all in there. Everyone at your school, they're all in there. Everyone in the neighborhood, they're all in there. One fine day, you stood at the bank, gents, and you looked at a girl and said, honey, I promise you, you and I, let's hold hands. Let's jump into the lake together. And together, we can have a go at finding this moon. Because once we find it, our lives will be complete. So you made that promise, till death do us part. So you jumped in together in the hope that you will find what? The moon in the lake. So now the two of you are swimming around together. Oh, how romantic. How so very romantic. And after a few years of swimming around together, but having no hope, or still hopeful, but still hopeless at the same time, what do you do? Let's get some more help. Let's bring in a few extra hands. Right? So, 9 months later, a few more join the party. Right? You want a few more people to help you find the moon. That's what you want to do. Now before you do that, you say, are we sure it's going to be here? Yeah, it's dead certain. I mean, let's just walk up to the bank again and have a look. Just to be sure, just to be double sure. So you walk up to the bank again and have a look. Oh, it's there. You can see the craters. And, you know, it's bright. It's bright as bright can be. So you decide, yes, let's do this. We can have a go. Let's try one more time. And you go in there. Jump back into the water. Again, swimming around. Trying to find the moon. So once in a while, you know, you're tired. Then what do? You just get around with all the other people. Everyone else who's in the water. You take a moment, you know, just take a breather, just relax for a little while. Relax. We are tired now, trying to find the moon. And then you'll feel many other people who are also just as tired. Just as tired as you are. And then there are some people who become depressed because they can't find the moon. Then they start going to the doctors. There are doctors. The doctors are also in the water trying to find the moon. They're also swimming around trying to find the moon, right? But what they claim, what they say is, the moon is there, right? The moon can be found, it's there, but if you are too exhausted, if you feel too tired, if you feel depressed because you haven't found it yet, then we can treat you. But should you give up looking for the moon? What would the doctors say? No. Don't give up, it's there. That's why I'm in it as well, says the doctor. So have you found it? Then, you know, from time to time, then you go looking for the clergy in the hope that they can help you. You go to the church, you go to the mosque, you go to the kovil, you go to the temple, in the hope that they can help you find the moon. That's what you're going there for. Sometimes you go to the Devali. And you know, you ask the gods, you try and appeal to the gods, and you know, gods, here's a basket of fruits, right, and a few thousand rupees in case it comes handy in that world. I mean, I don't know how you work out what the currency exchange rate is. So you try and bribe them in the hope that they will help you find the moon. So what you think is, if you please the gods, then they will tell you where the moon is. Yeah? These are the wishes that you make when you go to the Deva, or to this Panduru, you know, tying this Panduru in the Bodhi trees, and those is all sorts of pujas, services, right? You go in there, oh gods, almighties, or gods, devas, whoever's, I want to find that moon. I offer this to you. Please tell me where the moon is. And then some kapu over there will tell you, on, rain. Eswaha bhuta. And he'll tell you, in 2 moons time, 2 full moons time, get into the water. But you have to be virtuous. I mean, they will always put in some condition which they can always go back and say, it's because you didn't fulfill that condition, you couldn't find it. It always comes with a caveat. And so the moon's there, you have to, in 2 full moons time, get back into the water. And then you have to swim 10 meters forward and then take one turn to the left, then swim another 2 meters, and then one to the right, and another 3 meters. They'll give you this intricate map of how to find the moon, but they'll also throw in a few extra conditions, which chances are you will not fulfill. And so in 2 full moons time, you will go back into the water with your beloved wife, and now the children who are also there to help you. Go back into the water, go looking for the moon, and it won't be found. Of course not, won't be found. Why? Because you didn't follow instructions? Because you didn't follow the Kapha Mahatya's instructions? No, of course not. That's not why. But you will always go back to him and say, couldn't find the moon. What happened? Did you do exactly as I told you to? Yes, we did exactly as you told us to. Then he will ask you a few questions and convince you that no, you didn't follow all of the conditions that he'd laid down. That you had to remain vegetarian for the next 5 days. You had to breathe only from one nostril for the next two weeks. Huh? You mustn't blink for the next 3 days. So he will set a whole set of conditions that there's no hope that you can fulfill. Because he knows that, you know, because he's also in the water trying to find the moon. He's also in the water. I mean, how can he point to you what he hasn't found for himself yet? Honestly. Just think about it, folks. How can the Kapha Mahatya tell you where to find happiness when he hasn't found it himself? Otherwise, why is he in his job? Think about it for a second. You're intelligent people, don't insult your own intelligence. Right? So he will somehow convince you that you were, you know, it was your fault. And he says, okay, I'll tell you what to do next, but you have to give me another however much. And then you will ask another few people, a few more people, you know, we enter this Kapha Mahatya, that Kapha Mahatya is useless, but I know a really good Kapha Mahatya. Now he lives on the other side of the Himalayas. You go and see him. His rates are very expensive, but they say that he has helped more people, many people find the moon. You know, the thing is this, right? You just have to keep people running until they die. Right? After that, who's to say that it wasn't found? Yeah? You just have to keep people long enough in the water, right, until they're dead. Because after that, not that they have found it, but after that, who's to say that they didn't find it? And then some Kapha Mahatya, no, he found it. And then soon after he died. Then how are you to argue with him? You just have to accept. Therefore, ever hopeful that you will also find it somehow, hopefully before you're dead, you also get back into the water and go swimming, trying to find that moon. You see, the Bodhisattva was also someone who was in the water, along with all of us. He was also in the water, trying to find that moon. Just like all of you, he was also exhausted. But what he did was, one day when he was feeling really exhausted, he looked up. And he saw the moon. Then he asked himself, how come the moon's up there and down here as well? At the same time? Then he studied the moon. And he finally realized that the real moon is up in the sky. This is just a reflection. So he said, everyone in the water, hear me out. Come out of the water. Because while they are in the water, ladies and gentlemen, let's not forget the crocodiles. Let's not forget the crocodiles. They're also in the water. So you have to both look for the moon and try and avoid the crocodiles. So he says, hear me out, all you who can hear me. Come out of the water. There's no moon in there. I have seen the moon. Come out. It's not there. It's not in the water. You're just exerting yourself. Unnecessarily. This is just a useless effort. Because he sees how some people, you know, they're trying to find the moon, and instead of trying to come out of the water, they're trying to learn all these different strokes, swimming strokes. Someone's doing the butterfly stroke, like the other one's doing the breaststroke. Like they're all trying these different strokes to try and somehow swim this water, navigate this water in the hope that they can get to the moon sooner than someone else. But the Bodhisattva sees, the Buddha sees this when he finally sees that the moon's up in the sky, not in the water. And the water is, what you see is just a reflection. This is why I ask you to come out, step out of the water. What's the point of taking swimming lessons, ladies and gentlemen? You tell me. What is going to school akin to? If someone's looking for the moon in the water, what is taking swimming lessons against? Oh, what is going to school akin to? Taking swimming lessons. Yeah. It's like taking swimming lessons. It's like learning how to navigate the water, learning about the sea, the weed in the water. Where there are rocks and rocks you have to avoid, that's going to university. Because as you keep swimming deeper and deeper into the water, right, it's going to get more difficult and you can't put your feet on the ground. Right? So therefore you have to learn more tricks, more techniques, more skill. Therefore you have to keep advancing your subject, knowledge. So school education is not going to be enough. So you have to go do your degrees, your masters, your PhDs. So that you can keep swimming. Ever hopeful that one day you will discover or find the moon. That's why I have proven the point. You see, look at this audience. There are people here who have taken all sorts of lessons on how to find the moon in the water. And that's why they're all here. Because none have found it yet. How much longer do you want to keep swimming? How much longer do you want to keep swimming away from the crocodiles when you see one? When are you going to realize, ladies and gentlemen, that this effort that you are making is really utterly pointless? Utterly pointless. 13 years of schooling did just that. Those are the basic steps. We learn the basic steps of swimming in the water. That's enough just to, get knee-deep into the water. But when you want to start going beyond that, school is not enough. Then you have to start doing your degrees. And see, I asked you to put your hand up if you've done those degrees. So you know now how to get into the depths of the water. To do what? Don't be embarrassed. Yes, to do what? To go swimming, going looking for the moon. Any luck? Then once you get to the rocky part of the water, and there are these crocodiles swimming around, alligators and all sorts, and the hippos who are also in the water. I mean, there are a whole bunch of animals in the water with you. Then you have to get even more, you have even more education. Then there are those who decided, right, I can't do this alone, so I'll do it with someone else. So then you went in as a couple. As the saying goes, like, two brains are better than one. But what if they're both idiots? I'm just saying. I'm not saying you're an idiot. Don't do that. I just said, how can two brains be better than one if they're both idiots? So as a couple, now you go swimming in the water trying to find the moon. So traveling the world, finding residencies in other countries, settling down, getting foreign citizenships, all of these things were things that we did in the hope that we will finally somehow find the moon in the lake. But there is no moon to be found there. You are now, how many years of experience do you now have? See, each strand of grey hair on your head is evidence that you have failed. I talk to you with love, I hope you understand that. Each grey hair on your head tells me, tells the whole world really, that it was a failed attempt of trying to find the moon. Your knees are weak now. Sometimes when some of you come and worship Swaminarayan, you can't even stand up on your own. You need help. Why? Because now you are tired. Why? Swimming around in the lake trying to find the moon? That's why. You're weak, you're frail, you're exhausted. No wonder. If you keep looking for something that doesn't exist, on the time axis, where can you mark, plot, where you'll find it? Looking for something that doesn't exist, let's plot it on a graph, time axis. Where would you plot the point where you find it? Where? Nowhere. You will die before that. Yeah? That's what's happening to you. You will die before that. Maybe your philosophy of life is find the moon or die trying. Well, that's your philosophy of life. Find the moon in the water or die trying. That's what you're doing. Very seldom do we come across a sasana, the Buddha sasana, where there is this unique individual who swims out of the water just to take a break. Not that at that point he's realized everything. He just takes he just wants to take a break because he's exhausted just as much as everyone else. But he comes onto the bank, sits down and looks up at the sky. Out of sheer good fortune. Out of sheer good fortune, ladies and gentlemen, he looks up at the sky and what is that? No teachers to ask. No teachers to get counsel or guidance from. Just out of sheer luck, merit, power. And paramitas, perfections. They look up at the sky and go, whoa, what's that thing up there? It's massive. And then he sits and thinks, but what? Comes to a self-realization. Isn't that what I'd been looking for the last so many lives in samsara? And the moment he realizes this, with infinite compassion towards all beings in the water, he screams out loud with every ounce of energy that he can muster. Whatever life he has left in him, he goes forth trying to call out to people because he doesn't have to step into the water again. He says, come out, because why would he step into the water again? From wherever he is on the bank, he'll say, come out, come out, come out of the water. It's pointless being there, come out. But some people are much further away. They're too far away from the bank, they can't even hear him. And some are steadily swimming in that direction as well. That's why very few people escape samsara, ladies and gentlemen, even during a Buddha's era. Very few people do. The others are far too busy. They have submerged in the water now in the hope that they can find it. And they remain submerged for the entirety of their life. At 10, 15, 20 years, they submerge, and then as a couple, down into the water. And down there, they're looking for the moon. By the time they come back up, they're 80. 60 years have gone by. And then they hear a faint voice, come, come out of the water. They look out, and yes, they can see there's someone calling to come out of the water, but now they don't have enough life left in them to swim across the lake and get to the bank. They know that even if they start swimming now, they will die halfway on the journey. Some can't even hear that voice because they're too far away. Some are playing with each other. They're having fun. They're doing water sports. They're just, you know, splashing water on each other. You know, just for relaxation, apparently. They just want to relax. They're having fun. You know, a few friends get together and then now they're doing water sports. So they can't hear because it's too loud. The people are crying now, you know, laughing, cracking jokes at each other. Right? They're throwing water at each other. When there's a Buddha out on the bank calling out saying, "Hey, come out, come out." Some crazy man is waving at her, "Hey, bye." Yeah, there are people like that. They're too far out. They can't hear what is being said, but they see someone waving. Yeah. That man's still probably trying to get into the water. Maybe he's waiting for the right moment. But look at us. We are so far into the water, unlike that man. He's only still dipping his toes in the water. This is what who says? Those people who are still in the water. To whom? That one man who's come to realization. And he's calling out to everyone. They think he's waving at them. Now, you know, I'm painting all these characters for you. You identify which character you are. I don't know which one you are. But I'm illustrating these characters out to you. You figure out which character you are. Are you the one who's waving at the Buddha saying, "Hey, he's waving at us, wave back." It's rude not to. Or are you the one who's just playing, you know, with a few friends? You're just playing, you know, splashing water at each other, just having fun. Or are you the one who has submerged in the water? Therefore, by the time you come back out, that man who's on the bank, right, he'll be dead. He won't be there, because he won't be there forever. His voice will not last forever. But here's what he knows. He knows that he won't last forever. So what does he do? To every soul who decides to come onto the bank, he tells them, "This is why I called you. Look up at the sky now. Do you see the moon?" "Yes." "Well, that's why you were never going to find it in the water. Do you realize?" "Yes." "Do you want to step back into the water?" "Oh, no, sir." "Is there anything that's going to convince you to step back into the water?" "No, sir." "What if I pushed you into the water?" "I would come back out, sir." "Can I give you all the money in the world? Would you then step into the water to go find the moon?" "Oh, no, sir." "Why no?" "Because I have figured that the moon is up in the sky. Not a lifetime of searching for it in the water is going to help me find it. That's why I'm convinced. Not because you say so, but I'm convinced." Then this man, the pioneer, he says, "Right, do me a favor. I'm not going to be able to do this forever. Therefore, will you join me and call out to others? Think of everyone as a brother, as a sister. These are the very people that you swam with together. These are the very people with whom you went looking for the moon in the water. They were there when you were tired. They were there to play with you, fool around with you, joke with you, laugh with you. Right? They were there for you when the crocodiles came for you. Sometimes they sacrifice a limb for you, an arm for you. Sometimes they sacrifice their lives for you. Would you do me a favor? Would you keep calling out to them?" And then they say, "Yes, we would, sir. That's what I'm doing." That's what Swami knows he's doing. That's what those who see the moon will do once they have seen it. But you tell me this. What would those who have yet to see the moon, who are still in the water, say back to the people on the bank? What do you think they're going to say? "Fools. Look at them looking up at the sky. when they should be looking at the water. They should be looking at the water because that's where the moon is. It's where we are. Leave it. Leave it. Don't ask him to leave it. It's back. That's why I said leave it. So when are you coming? Going to come out? This is the thing, right? Those who are in the water, they think those who are out, and they have no longer any interest in getting back into the water because they have seen the moon, and now they are calling out to people to come out, because you have to first come out of the water to see the moon. At least you have to come out until it, you know, you can stand in the water, stand up so that you can listen to what is being said, because you can't hear what they're saying while swimming. Right, you have to at least be able to stand. If you have merits, you start swimming in the direction of the bank. Those who have little merits or no merits, they keep swimming in the opposite direction, further and further into the water. And the crocodiles get them. Trust me when I say this, ladies and gentlemen. Every lesson you learned at school, every degree you did, every course you took, every language you learned, unless they were done for the sake of your salvation, was all a lesson on how to swim in the water and remain in the water. And how to keep going further and further and further into the water. How to escape the crocodiles. How to swim away from the crocodiles. Those were the lessons that you learned. What's the point? What's the point? You know, if you are rich enough, you can get yourself a swimsuit. Nice? Oh. Nice, no? If you can get yourself a swimsuit? With all the options, pockets, right? So you can have your like little valuables, you can put it just in with a zip. Nice, you know, nice material, it'll last long. Long lasting material, very comfy. See? It's nice, isn't it? So the wealthier you are, the richer you are, the more comfortable your swimsuit is. Isn't that nice? Is it not nice to have a nice swimsuit if you are in this lake trying to find the moon? Why? Why are you nodding your head like this? Because you are still doing something that is useless, worthless, futile, isn't it? That's why. It's a Sisyphean task. No point. No point in doing it. What if they, you know, what if you could pay, if you had enough money so that you could pay for like a, maybe in the middle of the water they have a little raft. Right? You can get on it and stay there for a little while. Let's call that Hawaii. Or Dubai. Shall we? Let's call it Hawaii, Dubai, Singapore, whatever. These nice places that you like to go and go and take a, go for a resort, for a little holiday. So it's a nice raft, but you have to be able to afford it. And the best thing is, the more you keep swimming, the more you earn. That's also good, isn't it? That's how it works. The more you keep swimming, the more you earn, and with what you have earned, you can pay rent to remain on this raft. So, but the moment you step onto the raft, now it costs you. right? Money that you have earned by swimming. So what must you do as soon as you run out if you want to remain? Come back again to the raft, what must you do? Get back into the water and start swimming. See, you worked it all out. What amazingly intelligent people you are. You worked it all out. And if people keep bumping into each other, then they'll put lanes. Right? Because you have to have some rules, some regulations, right? So they'll have traffic, lake traffic. Then they have traffic police. So they're also swimming. But while they're swimming, what they do is they direct traffic. So you can swim in your lane. Don't get into other people's lane. Give each other some personal space. And if you get into any arguments while you are, you know, swimming around, bumping into each other, then you can go to court. They have courts there. All in the middle of the lake. See? How sophisticated this civilization is? We are very advanced, aren't we, as a human race? We are so good at doing something really stupid. Don't you think so? That we Homo sapiens are so incredibly good at doing something so insanely stupid. Let's give all ourselves a pat on the back, shall we? So they have the courts. Then they have little, you know, legislature. They have governments there. Because you have to now have a government to control all these people who are all swimming in the water. All doing what? Trying to find the moon. And then they have these geographical boundaries in the water. So if you want to cross into someone else's part of the lake, you have to get a permission for that. They call them visas. You've got to submit an application and wait for it to come back. And if you remain in there long enough, yeah, if you remain there long enough and swim around, you know, just help each other, help people in that part of the lake, right? They consider you for permanent residence. Idiots. And then they'll appoint like rulers, right? And then once you go and pledge your allegiance to that ruler in that part of the lake, right? They make you a citizen of that part. So then you can remain there without any time restrictions. Otherwise, they give you like 1 month, 3 months, 6 months. Sometimes you can go there, but you have to work. They're called working visas. Other times you have to go there, but you can only study but not work. They're called study visas. Other times if you want to take your spouse, the person with whom you are swimming around in this lake to try and find the moon, right, then you have to get a spouse visa to cross these boundaries in the lake to do what? Find the moon. I don't know why you are still here listening to this sermon. Have I not insulted you enough? Come on, be offended, please. What do you want with your lives? What do you want to do with your lives? How much longer do you want to keep swimming, ladies and gentlemen? You're trying to find a moon where it doesn't exist. But the really sad part of it is, when you come back out and you look back into the water, it seems like it's still there. So every new person that comes into this game, every newborn that comes into this world, they stand on the bank and look at the water and go, ah, there it is. And all these 8 billion people swimming around this lake trying to find the moon. Why can't I? If they can, why can't I? And then there are the motivational speakers, you know, from time to time they appear. I say, you can do it, come on, you can do it, my boy, you can do it. Never give up, you can do it. I say, so, you know, you fall for that. And you go into that as well, you know, the motivational speakers, they motivate you. You set your goals, set your dreams, set your ambitions, wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning and you can do it, man, you can do it, my man. So, you know, they wake up and they go and do it. I did this to myself and to others. That's why I'm trying to wash away my sins. That's why I look at you, swimming around in this water, jumping around in the water, splashing water at each other, holding hands and swimming as couples, like promising your children that they will somehow find it even if you don't, and that you're going to give them a head start, this head start that your parents never were able to give you, at all these lovely, wonderful stories that you paint in their heads, and then you send them to swimming school to learn how to swim around in the water, and crocodile school to learn about crocodiles and how to avoid them. What are you doing, honestly? There's a Buddha out on the bank. There are his disciples out on the bank. Right? They're calling out to you and say, come in our direction. If you come close enough, then we will tell you that there is no moon in the water, the moon's up in the sky. It's only a reflection, it's a mere reflection. But that reflection is so vivid, it seems like the real thing. Why won't you open your eyes? How much longer do you want to do what you're doing? What are the other goals and ambitions that you think once you've achieved you will somehow fulfill your purpose? Why do you think, ladies and gentlemen, once you make your next million, you will somehow find the moon? Why do the young people in this audience think once you've married and settled down, you will then find the moon together? Why? Why do the young couples here think that once you have your child, you will then find the moon? Why bring that innocent child into this world and then send them on a wild goose chase? Why? Should we not be more responsible as parents? I mean, heck, you were born to Buddhist parents. You were born to a heritage. There's a legacy. This is your inheritance. This is your greatest inheritance. It is within you, you know, when you see a Swaminarayana, you stand up. That devotion, that piety is all within you. You have it in your system. There are many who don't. To them, monks, foreign, very foreign. At least when the monk waves at you, you don't wave back at him, do you? You know that he's calling, it's a calling, so we must answer to that. But that's a very few people, a very few number of people who are like that. The vast majority, they don't even recognize the robe. They don't recognize the Buddha. They don't recognize the Buddha's voice, that his Dhamma, his teaching. Therefore, if I went to one part of the world, most parts of the world, just like I am, and then I walk up to them, people are like, why is that beggar on the street? Asking what he wants. Doesn't have any shoes also. Riffraff. Not suitable for our neighborhood. Send them away. That's what they would say. But you are not like that because you have that inheritance, you have that heritage. But what are you doing with that heritage is my question. You have been gifted that heritage, ladies and gentlemen. What are you doing with it? Don't keep swimming in the opposite direction until you can no longer hear the voice. Until the image of the monk becomes so far away, so further away, so unrecognizable, so faint, that you would not be able to tell him apart from anyone else. Don't wait until you have swum so far into the water. Like I said, your merits bring you closer to the bank, so that you can hear what is being said and understand it. Every demerit you do puts you in the opposite direction. And all this can only be done while you are still alive. Please understand that they will come one day. For your good fortune, you might hear the voice and say, "Oh, those are monks, they are waving at us. We have been trying to find the moon and we are pretty damn exhausted. Let's try and swim back." But alas, there's not enough life left in us. You work out the map then. There's so many kilometers to swim. Back up to the bank, and I'm already 65. Then. In this game, every step you take in the opposite direction is a wrong step. It's better not to swim at all than to swim in the opposite direction. But you can't remain like that in society, because society constantly expects you to swim. So with society's pressure on your shoulders, with society's peer pressures constantly pushing you to swim, and those demands and those expectations placed on you, on your children, on your family, then you have to swim. You can't just do nothing. Because doing nothing is considered failure. You are a loser if you do nothing. Therefore, you can't not just do nothing, you also have to do the wrong thing. See how dangerous that is? There's one thing better than doing the wrong thing, that is to do nothing. But you can't do nothing, because society expects you to do the wrong thing. That's what you learnt at school, how to do the wrong thing. That's what I learnt at school, how to do the wrong thing. How to keep swimming further and further away from the bank. The Buddha's here. The Dhamma's here. The Sangha's here. The Noble Triple Gem is here. Those who have seen the moon are here. They looked up at the sky, helped by their teachers, helped by Noble Association. They looked up at the sky and then they saw the moon, and then henceforth they never ventured into the water. They will stand at the bank and they will call you. But you must answer. That is why the Buddha always says, "I can show you the path, but I can't walk on your behalf." Why can he not walk on your behalf? Because he is already on the bank and you are in the water. The Buddha can't get into the water to come and get you and drag you. And it won't work like that, because even if he did, you would still want to try and swim in the opposite direction. You will think that the Buddha is a crocodile. If he grabbed you by your arm, by your wrist, by your foot, you would think that that's a crocodile got you. And you will try and shake it off and keep swimming in the opposite direction, away from the crocodile. Tumme hikichang atappan akkataro tathagata. Everyone to themselves. The Buddhas can only show the path. What are you waiting for? How many more years of your life do you want to waste? How many more precious moments do you want to waste? How many more people do you want to fool? How many more people with whom do you want to jump into the water and go on this meaningless rat race and pull them along with you? In vain, ladies and gentlemen, in vain. Every child you bring into this world and point them in the wrong direction is a wasted life. I'm not against you bringing children into this world. Become parents, that's okay. But please point them in the right direction. Please. Just because we are parents doesn't give us the right to ruin our children's lives and point them in the wrong direction. Don't you agree? Is it not our responsibility, if we take the responsibility of bringing a new child into this world, to bring a new life into this world, is it not a responsibility that we have unto ourselves to then point them in the right direction? We're not cats and dogs. We're not pigs just to bring children into this world and then just, you know, leave them and let them to fend for themselves. We're not like that. We're human beings. So we have a responsibility. But if you are not prepared to do that, it's better not to bring them into this world at all. Because again, you are pointing them in the wrong direction. Like I said, what's worse than not swimming at all is swimming in the wrong direction. My parents once pointed me in the wrong direction and I swam. I swam in that direction, along with them, behind them. Today, I call them to come out of the water. The moon's not in the water. Does this make sense to all of you? Do you understand that every effort you make to swim away from the bank is a waste of time? Is wasted energy? Do you? That is wasted effort? It's a waste of a precious life that you have been gifted with. You know, each of you is a gift, ladies and gentlemen. Each of you is a gift. I'm not saying you have a gift. You are the gift. Look at yourselves. You are a gift. You are an opportunity. You're here. You're present. You're alive. For heaven's sake, you're alive. You are the gift. You are the gift. Don't spoil it. Don't waste it. You might ask me, but Swaminathan, what about all these other people that are swimming in that direction? Should I not swim with them? Well, you work out the answer. You say, but my duties, my responsibilities, my obligations, you know, they're all swimming with me in this direction. We all started together. My wife and I, we started together. My husband and I, we started together. Now I have seen that there's no point in doing this. Should I not still swim with him? You work it out. Whether you think you should or not, you work it out. I don't think I need to work that out for you as well. After having explained to you all this, I don't think the onus is on me to then explain to you whether you should swim with them or not. What do you think? You tell me, folks, if your husband puts his finger into the fire, are you going to do the same? Because you're a married couple, so you have to do everything together as a couple. So if he jumps in front of a running bus, do you do the same? Why not? What is your argument against that? You would say, well, if he wants to suffer, let him, why should I? This is my life, that's his life, there's no point two of us suffering, there's no point both of us suffering, right? That's what you would say. Then if that is true in that, why is it not true in this? Why do you ask me, Swaminas, if my husband is swimming in the opposite direction to the bank, should I do the same? Why should you even ask me that question? Swaminas, if my wife and children, they don't want to escape, they just want to remain in the water, play with the crocodiles, should I do the same, Swaminas? You know, Swaminas, but I brought them, I promised them that I will be with them in the water. I promised them when I brought my children into this world and I swam them to swimming classes and swimming school and crocodile school, I told them that I will be with them forever. But now I realize that what you're saying is true. And true freedom is only in the opposite direction. So should I remain with them now, Swami Nuhansa? With the crocodiles? Seriously, that's a question you have for me? You can't work it out on your own, what you must do or not. So, you know, the jury's out. You decide for yourself. That's why I did as much convincing as I could with my people. I said, you know, this is the way it is. I've realized at this point, this is pointless. These are all just treadmills we are running on. No point in doing this. If you want to come with me, you come with me. Otherwise, I'm going to go anyway. Fortunately, she saw the same light that I did. So, we both swam out. Soon after, my parents, they saw. He said, help us, Putha Swami Nuhansa, help us. Yes, I will. So just as Dhammaruchi Hamaru Nuhansa talked to his parents of sansara, I talk to mine as well, I speak to mine as well. The Buddha's out there, he's gone now. He couldn't live long enough for us to hear his voice in person, but we are so fortunate that there were others before us who stepped out of the water having heard his calling, and they promised him that for as long as they're alive they will keep calling. And I heard one of those voices, and then I walked out, stepped out of the water, and then I promised to my teacher what my teacher promised to his, that I will keep calling until I can. This is that call. But this call will not last forever. Not this call, not this collective voice. In another 2,500 years, there will be no one on the bank calling out. Then for eons at a stretch, no one will bother walking out to the bank. Everyone will just be busy, frolicking, playing in the water, swimming among the crocodiles, taking mini breaks on the platform in the middle of the water, for which they will have to pay money that they will have earned by swimming around. So when they have run out of it, what do they have to do? Get back into the water and start swimming again. This is how you go on holiday. Does that make sense to you? And think. Think, decide, act. If you don't think, you will come to no decision. If you don't decide, you will take no action. If you take no action, you will see no change. You will be left in the same miserable life that you have always had to live. And Swami Nuhansa will come and go. Today I am here, someone else will be here in another day. Swami Nuhansa will keep occupying this seat, and you will keep occupying which seat? That seat. Remember, don't give yourself credit for that, for taking these seats up, okay? This is a hospital. You are patients waiting to be seen by the doctor. Don't give yourselves credit in that way for occupying these seats. I admire you for showing up, but I don't admire you for remaining in these seats. That, frankly, with love for you, I cannot admire that. How can I? How could I? How can I admire you for remaining in these seats? I can admire you for showing up. I can admire you for taking time out to come and be here. But how could I admire you for being in these seats year on year on year on year on year, and lifetime after lifetime after lifetime after lifetime, and Buddha's era after Buddha's era after Buddha's era after Buddha's era? How could I admire you for that? What good doctor would admire his patients for turning up every day? Then what good is the doctor? The doctor's job is to make sure that his patient doesn't have to come back again. That is what the job, that is what the doctor's job is for. Let's leave it there. Please think. Think, decide, act. Let's take a moment then to transfer the merits that we have all acquired today by making offerings to the infinite virtues of the Noble Triple Gem, by inviting the Swami Nivas to deliver the sermon and creating a conducive environment for all to come along and practice the Dhamma. First and foremost, let us transfer these merits to the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas, who have since time immemorial protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Buddha and passed it down through the generations of the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is thankfully available to us today to study, understand and comprehend the Dhamma. Let us take a moment to transfer this message to the Mahanayaka Theras, the Anunayaka Theras of all the chapters who have made it their life's purpose to protect and preserve the Sambuddha Sasana. Let us also transfer this message to the monks and nuns resident in your local temples and nunneries who have always been by your side through thick and thin, come rain or shine. Let us also transfer this message to my teacher, Guru Swami Nuhansi, as well as all the monks resident at the monastery and the Anagarikas and Anagarikas attached to the monastery. Let us also take this opportunity to transfer merits to friends of the monastery, our devotees, all of you, who provide the Mahasangha with shelter, arms, robes and medicines, as well as pass on your know-how and continue to extend their well wishes. Let us also transfer this merits to our parents, siblings, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews and nieces, our friends, our acquaintances, our employers and our employees, our teachers, as well as anyone and everyone who have helped us, supported us and assisted us in any way, shape or form. May they all rejoice in these merits and by the power of these merits. May they be freed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to the Devas and Brahmas, spirits and demons, primarily the Sakadeva, as well as all the numerous gods and deities who have committed themselves to fulfill and preserve the Sambuddha Sasana. Let us transfer this message to our guardian deities who keep a watchful eye over us and keep us out of harm's way. May they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also transfer this message to our forefathers, our ancestors, those who have passed away in our name, reminding ourselves that it is then their blood, sweat and tears today we are able to enjoy the comforts of life as we do. Let us also transfer this message to members of the armed forces as well as the police force who sacrificed their lives to protect the peace and harmony of our nation, as well as those who lost their lives in the wars, be their friend or foe. Let us also transfer this message to those who lost their lives in natural disasters and calamities such as tsunamis and earthquakes, landslides, fires, floods, pandemics and so on, reminding ourselves that in this infinitely long journey of samsara they will all have been parents to us, siblings to us, friends of ours. And with an abundance of compassion and loving kindness and a sense of gratitude for all that they have done for us, let us transfer these merits to all of them. By the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful planes, may they redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plane. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may by the power and blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of arahants on this blessed land. And finally, may you and I and everyone who's helped make this program a success become arahatan mahanse or an arahatarani mahanse in this very life itself and in the era of this Sri Sambuddha Sasana itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. The Mahasangha will now transfer the blessings to you. Ragaginnin midatnva Dveshaginnin midatnva Mohaginnin midatnva Nibbana parama sukhayam Sukhita taravetma Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravetma Mamadasya lulaka Siyanu satmayo nibbana parana sukhayan sukhita talavetva nibbana parana sukhayan sukhita talavetva nibbana parana sukhayan sukhita talavetva raga rini niveva dvesha gini niveva moha gini niveva nivansapalaveva nivansapalaveva nivansapalaveva. තුන්රුවන්ගේ සූසි අනන්ත මහා ගුණ බලෙන් සියලු ලෝක සියලු සත්වයන් නිබ්බාන පරම සුඛයෙන් සුගතතර වෙත්වා. සාදු සාදු සාදු.